Kent's Cavern in Torquay is one of the most significant archaeological sites within Britain, with an extensive warren of spectacular caverns. In fact, the cavern is the oldest recognisable human dwelling in Britain and is listed as an ancient monument and an historical site of special scientific interest. And when we did a tour of those caverns a number of years ago, the guide at a set point on the tour turned all of the lights out, and it was pitch black. I mean, the darkness was so intense that you couldn't even see your hand placed right in front of your eyes. You simply couldn't move without the fear of walking into something or tripping over something. We were completely stuck where we were until the guide turned the lights back on again. And over the years, I've often reflected on that experience, because this world, the society that we live in, is very much like that group that I was in the Kent Cavern, in complete darkness, not even able to see their hand in front of their face. Knife crime is on the increase. Horrific acid attacks, motorbike muggers, and all of those are just the very tip of the iceberg. And it's not just society that's like that, so are individuals. Human lives could be looked at as people stumbling around in the pitch dark. People are so disorientated in the dark about the value and meaning of life, they're in moral blindness. They hit their head on this, they stub their toe on that, and it leaves them battered and bruised emotionally and spiritually and morally and relationally. They're not sure what's hit them or who they've hit. And into that situation, Jesus comes and he says, "Do you know what society's problem is? Do you know what your problem is personally as an individual? You need to turn the light on so that you can see." Just as our tour guide in the Kent Cavern turned the light on for us. And the issue is, how can we turn the light on if it's pitch dark and we can't see even to find our way to the switch? Well, Jesus comes along and he says, "I can turn the light on for you because I am the light." John chapter 8 and verse 12. John chapter 8 and verse 12. When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Now, within that statement that Jesus makes is first of all a metaphor, and then there is a great claim, and then there is a calling. The metaphor is the light of the world. The claim is that Jesus is the light of the world. And the calling is for us to follow Jesus, and then we will have the light of the world. Now, these three things are hugely important. And so that's what we're going to be looking at today, looking at the significance of each one of them. So first of all, let's think about the metaphor. Let's think about the significance of that metaphor. Because the light of the world is a really profound metaphor that Jesus uses. Compared to what we have, the people at Jesus' time had very little concept of what this metaphor was that Jesus was using. And even today, we're just scratching at the surface. And yet, we do have a great deal of information about light. We have a great deal of information about the wonder of light and also the danger of light. I mean, just think for a moment. What is the light of this world? Wonderful, but it's incredibly dangerous. First, the light of the world is sunlight, isn't it? If we didn't have the sun, we would freeze. Even if it went behind a cloud for a couple of years, we would die from the lack of light. because all of the plants would die and the food chain would be destroyed. It's the most basic source of our life. But light is not only just a source of life, it's also the source of truth. Let's say, for example, I was riding along on my bike and there was a tree up ahead. Now, there are a couple of ways that I can get information about that tree. A couple of ways I can get information about the reality of that tree in front of me. A couple of ways I can get information about the environment that's around me. One easy way is to ride straight into the tree. That's a very fast way, but it's not the best way of getting information about the tree. Because as I ride my bike along, I would like some information of the fact that there is a tree up in front of me. I'd like to know the size of the tree. I'd like to know its location and its shape, hopefully before I ride into it. And the only way for me to get that kind of information that is helpful to me, through light. The light bounces off the tree. It hits my retina and it tells me exactly where the tree is and what the tree is. That's the fact. If you try to find your way to the bathroom in the pitch dark in a house that you're not used to, you're going to smack into things. You're going to stumble over things because you don't understand the environment in which you are. You see, light not only gives me life, it gives me truth. It gives me information, knowledge about my environment in which I live. But do you know, light also is one of the most basic sources of joy. What if you thought about that? One of the basic sources of joy. You know, people who have to stay at the North or the South Pole during those weeks and weeks and weeks of endless darkness, they wrestled tremendously with depression and despair. We're only just now beginning to understand that people need light, not just for life, not just for knowledge and truth, but also for happiness and contentment and joy. It even brings us a degree of comfort. You know, a little child wakes up in the middle of the night screaming. They maybe have had a nightmare. What's the first thing you do as a parent? Well, if you want to comfort the child, you turn the light on, don't you? Turn the light on. Light is wondrous then for all of these things, but here's one of the things that's so profound about this metaphor. The same light that is really our only main source of life and truth and joy and comfort is also something that if it's unmediated will take all of that away. Light is every bit as dangerous as it is wonderful. And therein lies an enormous paradox. For example, unmediated sunlight without protection is deadly. It would be the end of all life. Now, of course, everybody disagrees about the state of the ozone layer, but here's one thing that nobody disagrees with. If the atmosphere would deteriorate even just a little bit, more and more people are going to die of cancer. The oceans are going to dry up. The deserts are going to spread and life is going to die. Without light, we die. And with light, we die. Unmediated light takes away everything that we need light for. Life itself. But not only that, it will take away sight, truth, and the ability to know what is out there in our environment. I mean, just look to an eclipse of the sun with the naked eye and you will be blinded. The light of the world that is so vital for all of these aspects of life blasts right through and will burn out your optic nerve. And there's something else about light. Light is also deeply disturbing. It will take away your joy and comfort. Just think about a teenager with severe acne. They can perhaps handle looking at their face in the bathroom mirror with a dim light on. But one thing they won't want to do is to go out into a big department store with all of the bright lights on round every corner. And the reason why they don't want to do that is because they want to avoid what the light is showing what they really look like. And you know what? I'm not sure human beings can possibly be happy to really know what they look like spiritually, psychologically, emotionally, morally, or even physically. We need light for life, and yet if we get light, it will kill us. We need light for knowledge of our environment, but if we get that light, it will take it away. We need light for joy and comfort. Without it, we'll get into depression or fear. But with light, we'll get into depression. How profound is that? You begin to see the enormity of the metaphor that Jesus is using here. Only when we grasp the significance of this metaphor that we can begin to see the significance of Jesus' claim. Now we can begin to see what Jesus is telling us. He says in verse 12, I am the light of the world. Now let's just see how an incredible claim that is. In verse 20, he spoke these words while teaching in the temple courts, near the place where the offerings were put, yet no one seized him. Jesus said, I am the light of the world, and nobody seized him. John is telling us that if you really understood what Jesus was claiming, you would be amazed that he wasn't arrested right there on the spot. So what is it that Jesus is claiming? Well, first of all, let's realize what was occurring and where Jesus was when he said this. Back in verse 12, it says, when Jesus spoke again to the people. And that word again means we're going to have to look further back in the passage to find out when that was. Now, verses 1 to 12 are a little bit of an interlude in the narrative. So we actually have to go back to chapter 7 and verse 37 to see that Jesus was in Jerusalem on the last night of the Feast of Tabernacles. This festival commemorated God's provision for the Israelites in the wilderness. They celebrated the great things that God did to provide for them in the wilderness. And one of the things that they did was they lived in these little booths to remember what it was like to not have a home. And they poured out water, reminding them that when they were dying of thirst in the wilderness, Moses struck the rock and water came out. The water, of course, satisfied their thirst so that they didn't die. And a third thing that they did every night was they lit an enormous candelabra at one place in the temple. And it had a number of huge lamps on it. And these lamps were so huge that when they were lit, they just flooded the rest of the city. And then the orchestra struck up and people cut loose and started to dance and celebrate. The festival was all about remembering and celebrating. Not just how God had given them shelter, not just how God had given them water, but also how God had given them light in the wilderness. And do you remember how? As they were leaving Egypt, suddenly something appeared before them. In the daytime, it looked like a cloud, and it actually sheltered them. It sheltered them from the sun. And when the sun started to go down, instead of what usually happens to clouds, you know, they get invisible, well, this cloud began to radiate. This cloud began to glow. And when the sun went all the way down and is at its darkest, and it was at the blackest of black, the cloud became a pillar of fire. And when they got to Mount Sinai, the cloud came down on the mountain in thunder and flame. And when they built the tabernacle, this cloud appeared over the tabernacle. And whenever the cloud picked up and started moving, they followed it. And when they built the temple in 1 Kings chapter 8, the cloud came down and no one could even stay on their feet because the glory of the Lord filled the temple. Look in Exodus 13 and verse 21. It says, by day the Lord went ahead of them in the pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so they could travel by day or by night. And what was this cloud? Well, this cloud was the Shekinah glory of God. It was God's immediate presence with them. He came down and gave them light himself. And every night of the festival, they lit this great big candelabra in recognition of that. But on the last night of the festival, which is when this happened, they didn't light it because they were beginning to wind everything up. They were taking down all of the decorations. These giant festival lights were being extinguished and dismantled. And as the lights went out in the temple court, it was impossible not to realize in front of those cold, dark lamps that the glory light of God's cloud had not been seen in the temple or anywhere else for centuries. Prophet Ezekiel had actually declared Ichabod, which means the glory of God has gone. And so on the last night of the festival, having had light there throughout the whole week, when they finally go out, it's a time of despair. And we're told that's when Jesus walked into the temple courts, and we're told in John 8 and verse 20, he spoke these words while teaching in the temple courts, near the place where the offerings were put. He was literally at the treasury, right in front of the candelabra. And Jesus Christ stands before those candelabra that represent the missing glory of God. And he says, I am here. I am the light of the world. I am the glory light. The thing that you long for so much is here, the true light. In fact, the thing you wish would come back was only provisional. It was imperfect and it was partial. But I am the very glory of God. Jesus is saying, I'm not like the prophets of old that pointed you to the glory of God. I am the glory of God. I am God come to you. I am the way that the light of God can come centrally and permanently into you, and you can come into it. Verse 12, when Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me. See, when the Shekinah glory moved, the people followed the light through the wilderness. And Jesus is saying, I am the Shekinah glory here. Follow me. And by claiming that he was the light of the world, Jesus is saying, I am the source of ultimate light. I am the source of ultimate life and the source of ultimate truth. The source of ultimate joy and comfort. In terms of ultimate life, he is saying, I am the only one that can give you eternal life. When the sun comes up and the spring starts to get near the earth and things begin to melt and other things start to bud and grow. But when Jesus comes near, he actually becomes your light, then your life begins to melt. And the life of God comes into you and you begin to change. You begin to sprout. And that life will last forever. Jesus is saying, look, I am the source of ultimate truth. When he says, I am the light of the world, in front of those candelabra at the Feast of Tabernacles, on the night when the glory of the Lord had gone and was most felt that it was gone, what he is saying is, I am the only way for you to know who God is. Not saying no other prophet or no other teacher or no other faith or no other philosophy knows anything else about God But rather he's saying, what they are just like the moon, but I am the sun. They reflect God's glory, but I am God's glory. Of course, you can see a lot in the moonlight, can't you? You can get around in the moonlight, but it's like nothing compared to what you can see in the sunlight. See, this is quite a claim from Jesus, isn't it? The founder of every other world religion is actually saying, I am the moon. They're saying, look, I'm pointing the way to something. I'm not divine, but the divine is over there. I'm not God, but there's God over here. I'm not the way, but this is the way. And what they're all saying is, I am the moon reflecting. Now Jesus comes along and says, well, I'm not the moon. I'm the sun. And how do you know there is a tree right there in front of you? Because the light tells you. And it's not a reflected light that you might see from a pool of water that gives you a kind of vague understanding of where a tree is. This is direct. This is how the writer of Hebrews describes Jesus in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 3. The sun is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. He is God come to us. And Jesus is also saying, well, actually, I am the source of your ultimate joy and comfort. In fact, he is the ultimate beauty, the ultimate satisfaction. He's saying, look, do you want a beautiful life partner? Do you strive to have a beautiful body? Do you spend quite a bit of money to go to beautiful places? Do you like to listen to beautiful music? Do you like looking at beautiful art? Well, those things are never going to satisfy the deepest yearnings of your heart. He says, I am the beauty that you've been looking for. I am the beauty that will give you real joy and comfort and satisfaction. I am the only beauty. Those other things, well, they're just the moon. They're just reflecting my beauty. But I am the sun. Now, there's something else that he's saying. He's not simply saying, I am the glory of God, therefore I am the ultimate source of life and truth and beauty and joy. He's also saying, I am the mediator. You know, we have today the scientific insight to know that the very thing that we most need, sunlight, is the very thing that will kill us if we get it. Now, in the Old Testament, they recognized that about God. Because when the Old Testament showed that God was coming near, God wanting to give people light, God wanting to give people heat, God wanting to give people his shelter, he could only come so close. And when the glory cloud came down on Mount Sinai, Moses warned everybody, don't touch the mountain, otherwise you will die. And when the glory cloud came down on the tabernacle in Exodus 40 and in the temple in 1 Kings 8, the people just turned to jelly. They couldn't stand up and look at the glory of God. It was that great and it was that powerful, it was impossible to get near. Perhaps of all of the places you see this is when Moses comes to God in Exodus 33 and he actually says to God, well, now show me your glory. Now, what exactly is he asking? Doesn't he see it? There's the cloud. Moses is always seeing it. There it is. It's incredible. It's impressive. It's wonderful. Light that gives the way ahead. So what's he talking about? Well, Moses is saying, well, that is not enough. I want to get inside your glory. I want to see you face to face. And what does God say? He says, well, that will kill you. Because you have no mediator. It will overwhelm you and it will destroy you. And you'll remember that God puts Moses in the cleft of a rock so that the glory cloud can pass by and he can just see the hind part as it goes. And God says, you can't actually get what you want. So what should we do? Should we say, all right, look, near is close enough. We don't have to get inside God's glory. Well, this is what C.S. Lewis said in his sermon, The Weight of Glory. He said, God has given us the morning star or the sun. And you can go and enjoy the gift on many fine mornings if you're ready to get up early enough and it's clear. What's more, you might ask, do we want? Ah, but we want so much more. Some think the philosophers' books on ascetics don't take notice of, but the poets and the mythologies are filled with it. We do not want merely to see beauty. We want something else which can hardly be put into words, to be united with the beauty that we see, to pass into it, to receive it ourselves and to bathe in it. That's why the poets tell us such lovely falsehoods. They talk as if the west wind could really sweep into our soul, but it can't. They tell us that the beauty born of a murmuring sound will pass into the human face, but it won't. At present we are on the outside, on the wrong side of the door. We discern the freshness and purity of morning, but they do not make us fresh and pure. We all know that we're getting older, and we start to feel ourselves hardening up. We start to feel ourselves decaying. We start to feel ourselves wearing away. We see the freshness and the purity of morning, but it doesn't make us fresh and pure. So Lewis says, we cannot mingle with the splendours that we see before us. But then he says, all of the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumour that someday we shall get in. But you must not think that I'm putting forward any pagan fancy of being absorbed into nature. We are summoned to pass through nature, beyond her, into that splendour that she fitly reflects. So Moses says, I want to get in. I don't just want to be near. And God says no. Common sense tells us no. C.S. Lewis tells us we haven't really stopped wanting to be in. And Jesus comes along in John 8 and verse 12 and says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. He doesn't say, well, look, if you follow me, you'll be able to get near the light of life. He says, if you follow me, you'll have it. The very thing that God says to Moses, you can't, Jesus says to us, you must and you can. Now, how is that possible? Well, it's possible because Jesus is the mediator. In his incarnation, finally, the light can give us what we need without overwhelming us. You see, if you were an Israelite looking at the pillar of fire, you would see glory. And you would walk away saying, that's the glory of God. But look at Jesus. Look at him raising a little girl and saying, it's time to get up now. Look at the power of Jesus being able to raise someone from the dead without raising a sweat. Now we're beginning to see the glory of God in a way we could never have seen it before. Charles Wesley's carol goes, veiled in flesh, the Godhead see, hail, thou incarnate deity. See, the only way to look at the sun is to put a filter over it. Then you can see the flames. Otherwise it just burns you out. And Jesus Christ is the glory of God in a way that I can grab it, in a way that I can hold it, the way that I can embrace it. But of course we don't just need mediation, we need forgiveness. The light of God would not kill us simply because we're too weak for it. The light of God would also kill us because we are sinful beings. And God says to Moses, it will kill you, not because you need sunglasses, but because you are sinful and my light is pure, because in me there is no darkness at all. Now one night Jesus takes three disciples onto a mountain and he begins to radiate. And it began to look like his clothes and his face became as bright as lightning. And when the disciples woke up, they saw Jesus talking with Elijah and Moses. And as it says in Luke chapter 9, a rather strange word is used. You only pick it up in the Greek, but it says that they were talking to Jesus about his exodus. Most of the English translations will say his departure. But the word used is actually his exodus. And suddenly down comes a cloud around Jesus and the disciples, and they're petrified. And of course they would be. How on earth were they going to survive this? And yet the cloud, the glory, the light that hadn't been seen for centuries came down, and they didn't die. Instead, they heard a voice that said, "This is my son, listen to him." And soon they saw only Jesus, because he is the glory. And why is he a glory? Doesn't kill us? Simply because Jesus was the whole Exodus. And what's interesting about this episode is that Peter offers Elijah and Moses booths. Remember that? Shall we prepare some booths for you? Was Peter starting to gradually understand? Is this picturing the Feast of Tabernacles? Jesus is not just the glory cloud in reality. He is the whole Exodus. Jesus is the lamb that is slain so that they could get out of Egyptian slavery. Jesus is the rock from which they could drink water. He was the manna in the wilderness that they could eat. And he was the cleft in which they could hide themselves for what he has done for us. So that the glory light can come into us and we can come into him. And it won't kill us because we have been forgiven and we have been reconciled to the Father. And we begin to grasp the enormity of just that little metaphor that Jesus used here. The light of the world is the whole gospel contained in that phrase. The very thing we most need, if we get it, will kill us. But only because Jesus came and lived the life that we should have lived, died the death that we should have died, can we actually receive this light into our hearts, that it can finally come inside of us and we can come inside of that glory. We're not going to be outside on the wrong side of the door anymore. Now, Jesus doesn't stop there. He doesn't just say, "Well, isn't that great news?" What he says is, "Follow me." And so we must turn to the significance of the calling that he's given us. For a Christian, what does it mean when Jesus says, "Follow me"? Follow my light and you'll have it. Well, first of all, it is a call for us to live our lives with absolute consistency and integrity. It means we mustn't live our lives in the dark that so much of this world is living their life in. And sadly, so many Christians still do that. Some hide things from their spouse that they don't want them to see. Some hide things from their friends that they don't want them to know about. Some even hide things from themselves. But realize that the light is shining here. Or at least it's going to shine here inevitably, because Jesus is the light of the world. And so the call for us is, don't be different in the dark than when you're in the light. Don't be different when no one is looking to when everyone sees what you're doing. You see, if you understand that Jesus is your light and that he lives in you, then you will be the same person when no one's looking or when everybody's looking. But the call is to be a person of integrity. Second, it's a call for us to live attractively. Jesus says, "You are the light of the world." He is beautiful, but if he lives in us, is there anything beautiful about us? Because Jesus lives in us and shines through us. Is there anything remarkable about us? If people will watch us when we take criticism. People will watch us for how we treat other people. People will watch us in the way we deal with other people, how we handle difficulty. Are they amazed? Are they surprised? Is there anything beautiful about us in the way that we live? And of course, left to ourselves, the answer would have to be no, wouldn't it? But it's only because the light of the world, the light of the world, is living in and through us that any beauty emanating from us is possible. So for us, the calling is to surrender our lives to the light of the world, to let him have his way in and through us. And then third, the call is for us to live courageously. If you are light, then inevitably you're going to expose other people. You won't be able to help it. And over the years, Christian employees have been told things like, don't work so hard, because you're making the rest of us look terrible. You've got to lie about your expenses claim, otherwise we'll all be checked out. Don't hand over all the tips you get, otherwise we'll have to do the same. You see, simply by just doing the right thing, the Christian thing, you're going to expose people. People are going to say what those air raid wardens used to say in World War II. And if you're a fan of Dad's Army, you'll know exactly what they used to say. Put that light out! And that's what they'll say to us. Your light is shining, put it out. Because you're exposing us and our deeds. But you see, if you do put your light out, you're not following Jesus courageously. In fact, if no one has ever come and said to us, put that light out, is our light really shining? The question we have to ask, I have to ask that of myself, is our light really shining? Then fourth, we are to live hopefully. Did you realise in a sense that the sun in the sky is not up yet? The world is living in darkness because the fullness of the Son of God's kingdom is not here yet. And just think, as beautiful as nature is now, the picturesque mountains, the beautiful flowers, the design of a snowflake, look at some of the incredibly beautiful things there are, and yet the sun is not up yet. And so do you realise what it is going to be like? Do you realise what you and I are going to be like when the sun finally does come up? Do you realise the blossoms that are going to spring forth? Do you realise what it's going to be like when the new heaven and the new earth is here? So live hopefully, because that glorious future is just ahead of us. And so as we begin to draw to a close, let me ask you a question. Are you being stirred by the light of Jesus? Is it affecting you? When the light shines in our hearts, we cannot but be affected by that. When children are fast asleep and they need to get to school, a parent might go into their bedroom and fling wide the curtains and the light floods into the room. But you see, light is rousing. That's the purpose of light. Light makes it impossible for us to sleep, doesn't it? But it can induce one of two reactions. The child could jump out of bed and embrace the new day excitedly. Or they could recoil from the light and pull the duvet over their head and just want to carry on sleeping. One of two reactions. And spiritually, we can react in either of those ways to Jesus, the light of the world. Either we embrace him and want to go forward with him and follow him, or we can recoil from him, hide away. But Jesus' message is clear. Come into the light and follow me, and then you'll never have darkness. You will have the light of life. The conversion of the famous Baptist preacher Charles Spurgeon makes interesting reading if you ever get to read his biography. He woke up one January Sunday in 1850 with a deep sense of his need for deliverance. And because of a snowstorm that had taken place that day, the 15-year-old's path to church was diverted down a side street that he wouldn't normally go to. And for shelter, he ducked into a Methodist chapel. And he goes in and he sits down, and there's only one other person sitting in the church. And it turns out that the minister couldn't get there because of the snow. And so it was left to an elder to give the sermon. And He didn't normally preach and wasn't used to preaching. But he gets up and he opens the Bible and he reads one verse. This is his text for the day. And it's Isaiah 45 and verse 22. And the verse says, "Look unto me and be you saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God and there is none else." And he didn't know how to preach about that verse, and so he just kept repeating it. And he looks out over the congregation of two people and he says, "Look to me and be saved." Do you see? You don't have to do anything. You don't have to walk anywhere. You don't even have to take one step. Look. What the text says, look. All you can do is look. And you have to see that you can't do anything. You can't walk anywhere, you just have to look. And you have to see what he has done for you. Just have to look. And after he'd done that for about a quarter of an hour, he looks at the 15-year-old Spurgeon and he points at him and he says, "Young man, I see that you are miserable. And you're going to stay miserable until you obey this text." And Spurgeon later acknowledged that on that day, on his visit to that Methodist chapel, he was feeling unhappy and despondent and despairing. He'd been struggling to live a moral life, to fast and to pray in order to have a religious experience. But his life was full of sorrow and wretchedness, believing that he was lost. And as the preacher spoke to Spurgeon, he said, "I had this vision, not a vision to my eyes, but a vision to my heart. And I saw what a saviour Christ is." Now I can never tell you how it was, but I no sooner saw whom I was to believe, and I understood what it was I was to believe. He says, "I did believe in that one moment." And as the snow fell on his road home from just this little chapel, he says, "I thought every snowflake talked to me and told me of the pardon that I had found. For I now was as white as the driven snow that I was walking through by the grace of God." And upon his return home, his appearance caused his mother to say to him, "Something wonderful happened to you." When the preacher said, "You have to obey my text," it dawned on him, Jesus Christ is the light. Because the only way I can be saved, the look. Nothing I can do. I have to accept what he has done. Look to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth. And when the light of the world comes and confronts us, we can choose to recoil and run from the light. And those people, like Spurgeon was, will be miserable and will stay miserable until they obey that text. But on the other hand, we can come and we can look to the light and be saved. And when we obey that text, then it can truly be said of us, "Something wonderful happened to you."